Illustre auditoire, mesdames, messieurs, chers collègues. Quand Claudine et Serge Haroche m'ont invité à faire une conférence à ce colloque, j'ai naturellement tout de suite dit comme physicien, je ne m'y sentais vraiment pas à l'aise. Mes compétences ne sont pas dans les sujets de votre colloque. J'ai signalé que tout ce que je peux faire, c'est présenter mon point de vue personnel de non-expert. C'est précisément pour cela qu'on m'a invité et j'accepte donc volontiers cette invitation. I hope I have not overstressed your patience with my attempts in French. With your permission, I would like to continue in English. Allow me to start with a personal remark. In 1977, I came for the first time to the United States to research there. There I discovered that I had grown up and had been educated in Vienna in a special climate. I discovered this by realizing that I missed something. In Vienna, it was a deep appreciation of philosophical attitudes, even in the sciences. This has never been an explicit topic in my education at the University of Vienna, but apparently it was part of the atmosphere, otherwise I would not have missed it. Thus, I became interested in where this came from. In 1848, students assembled in the ceremonial hall of the University of Vienna. Today, this is the ceremonial hall of the Austrian Academy of Sciences. These students requested basic fundamental political freedoms. Most interestingly, the students who participated later formed the leading echelon of the constitutional state, which was to follow after some time. And even more interestingly, most of them came from the faculties of law and medicine. Just a remark, the classical university has four faculties, law, medicine, philosophy, and theology, which was then clearly Catholic theology. The university building where the students gathered in 1848 was built around 1750 under Empress Maria Theresia. She instituted a significant university reform. She created modern legal and medical education according to empirical, scientific, and rational methods. She left the theological and the philosophical faculties to the Jesuits. That way, Maria Theresia secured for the ideas of enlightenment in the culture of law a solid position in the empire. I might go even further back. After the Reformation, significant parts of Austria were Protestant. The Counter-Reformation introduced ritual and drama and a theatrical celebration of the Catholic Mass. It is my opinion that this led to an understanding that it was important to play one's role correctly. It also led to the theater being a primary carrier of our culture. And it also led to a distinction, this is my personal opinion, between what one believes inside, in one's own heart, and what one plays on the outside. To a certain extent, a theatrical culture resulted. This was expressed by Hugo von Hofmannsthal in the text of the opera Der Rosenkavalier by Richard Strauss, where the Marschallin says, und in dem Wie, da liegt der ganze Unterschied. And the whole difference lies in the how. As you all know, the revolution of 1848 was quenched, but the rise of liberalism and of the bourgeoisie could not be stopped. A most significant development in Vienna was the construction of the Ringstrasse in place of the old city bastions. The central part of the modern Ringstrasse, related to the liberal zeitgeist of the time, was the ensemble of university Vienna City Hall, Parliament and Burgtheater, all next to each other. Interestingly, and very much in the sense of my previous remarks, the Burgtheater was the most broadly accepted institution of the four. It was a platform where court and nobility could meet and interacted with the liberal bourgeoisie on an equal level. This is signified by Gustav Klimt's painted decorations of the ceremonial staircase in the Burgtheater, where he demonstrates the unity of theater and society. Members of the society vied to be included in that painting. Very different, shortly after, were his paintings of the four faculties in the ceremonial hall of the new university building in Vienna. There he depicted shadowy figures presenting what is hidden behind the surface. Naturally, these pictures drew a lot of fire. A significant event was the crash of the Vienna Stock Exchange in 1873, caused by the financial disaster of the World Exposition in Vienna. Apparently, as is commented by many, it started the end of the power of the liberal haute bourgeoisie in Austria. A year afterwards, Johann Strauss's Fledermaus was performed for the first time. Alfred, the lover of married Rosalinde, sings in a duet with her, "Glücklich ist, wer vergisst, was doch nicht zu ändern ist. Happy is the one who forgets that which cannot be changed." A clear expression of denial of reality, an expression of an aesthetic culture of escape from unpleasant social realities, social injustice, economic depression, and political corruption. The Viennese opera, which followed and blossomed until about 1930, always enlarged such such ignoring of the harsh realities of life, elevated all desires musically and never questioned them. Illusion was central to this general attitude. Clearly, this illusion played a very significant role in Vienna at that time. A most noteworthy example is Empress Elisabeth, who in kitsch culture is called Sissi. Apparently, she had in all her castles a picture of Titania. Titania was the queen of the fairies in William Shakespeare's play A Midsummer Night's Dream. Titania caresses the head of a donkey she loves. This is a symbol of illusions which we love and cherish. Alan Janik and Stephen Toulmin remark in their epochal treatise, Wittgenstein's Vienna, that the liberal era in Vienna cannot be understood by orthodox scholarly analysis alone. They talk explicitly of, I quote, a conception of philosophy as an autonomous, professionalized academic discipline, a conception that has become dominant in the universities of Britain and the United States only since the Second World War, is uniquely irrelevant to pre-1914 Austria. Similarly, Karl Eschorski writes in Traum und Wirklichkeit, Dream and Reality, that the Viennese culture at the time of the liberal rise was signified by a synthesis of the political, scientific, and aesthetic cultural forms. Much of this happened in the Viennese coffee houses. The role of the coffee houses is very often romanticized. But at that time, it was a sheer necessity. The reason was simply that Vienna was heavily overpopulated. Most homes only provided the absolute bare necessities of a sleeping place and were in many respects despicable and absolutely unhospitable, so everyone by necessity met in the coffee houses. Poets, philosophers, composers, other musicians, or to mention two people from other disciplines, the jurist Hans Kelsen and the economist Karl Menger. Another reason for the special position of Vienna at that time was its smallness. Vienna was then the smallest of the big capitals of the empires in Europe, which basically meant that everyone knew everyone. For example, Anton Bruckner gave piano lessons to Ludwig Boltzmann, Gustav Mahler looked to Sigmund Freud for psychological help, Johannes Brahms was a music teacher to the Wittgenstein family, Ernst Mach was godfather to Wolfgang Pauli, and Adolf Loos was godfather to Karl Kraus. Apparently, the intense interactions between different disciplines within this close-knit community led to enormous results. Karl Kraus writes that the aesthetic culture of the 1870s provided a refuge from unpleasant realities. The new generation afterwards broke away and looked in new uncompromising ways beneath the surface. But this also had other consequences. Hugo von Hofmannsthal wrote in 1905, "Das Wesen unserer Epoche ist Vieldeutigkeit und Unbestimmtheit. The essence of our epoch is multiple meaning and undefinedness." And he continues, "Wir sollten von einer Welt Abschied nehmen, ehe sie zusammenbricht. We should say farewell to a world before it breaks down." Apparently, the new generation, the leading figure in architecture was Otto Wagner. His church on Steinhof, a mental asylum, and his Postsparkasse pay tribute to his idea that material and function should coincide. To him, the outside surface was as important as the inside. The next step, very much in the spirit of what I just said, was taken by Adolf Loos, who had been a sharp columnist in Neue Freie Presse and called the Ringstraße a Potemkinsche Stadt, a Potemkin city. He stripped away the outside facade of its decorations and focused completely on the interior and on the view from inside to outside. His famous Loos House was built just across the Café Grünsteidl, which was the meeting point I just mentioned before, and across the private chambers of the emperor. Francis Joseph considered the house without eyebrows, as it was called, a personal insult. Apparently, the new generation of the 1870s and 1880s protested against the rationalism of their father generation. This also led to militant communist populism and to pan-Germanic nationalism. The populism itself led to a militant anti-Semitism. The nationalism apparently was much weaker in Vienna than in other parts of the monarchy, because Vienna was a multicultural and multi-ethnic city by virtue of its position as the capital of the multicultural and multi-ethnic empire. The anti-Semitism was exploited by various political parties in a populist manner to gain votes. Furthermore, anti-Semitism provided an easy excuse for not being able to solve various problems. Apparently, the anti-Semitism of Vienna at that time led to Theodor Herzl's dream of a Judenstaat, Jewish state. Herzl was originally hoping that assimilation and conversion to Christianity would lead to the resolution of the problem of anti-Semitism, but deep, disturbing personal experiences led him to think otherwise. Also, and this is quite important, in Vienna, over time, anti-Semitism turned from a religious basis to a racial one. I have already remarked on various ways of cognitive repression in Vienna at the time. It is therefore not surprising that this provided the most fertile ground for Sigmund Freud in his Traumdeutung, Interpretation of Dreams from 1900. He argued that even as the dream cannot be understood by the dreamer, the unconscious expresses in the dream nevertheless a way. The unconscious expressed in the dream nevertheless has a way to express itself. Karl Kraus commented, ihm gebührt das Verdienst, in die Anarchie des Traums eine Verfassung eingeführt zu haben, aber es geht darin zu wie in Österreich. Freud deserves the credit of having introduced the constitution into the anarchy of dreams, but what goes on there is mayhem just like in Austria. Freud's understanding of the unconscious did not hinder him to be among those who welcomed the beginning of the war. He expressed that his whole libido, as he says, belonged to Austria-Hungary. There was a loud hooray among many authors, with a few notable exceptions, like certainly Karl Kraus, Franz Werfel, or Arthur Schnitzler, just to name three. If we now turn to the time after 1918, the effects of the war, a most significant result was the complete abandonment of nobility and of identification by the Austrians with the House of Habsburg. There was never any noteworthy popular movement for re-establishing the monarchy. Vienna in 1918 has turned from a metropolis of a 50 million multicultural empire to the stagnant capital of a small country. The general and equal right to vote for men and women led in 1919 to a social democratic majority in the bankrupt Vienna. Two hunger winters followed the war because the supply of food and of energy was cut off by succession states of the monarchy, but Red Vienna, as it is called, became recognized later worldwide for its successful policies of general welfare and education and by solving the housing problem which had been so apparent just before the war. In culture in Vienna in 1920, the musical festival of the city of Vienna was started, which became the Wiener Festwochen Festival. Alan Janik and Stephen Toulmin argue that after 1920, not only the Habsburg Empire had become Balkanized, but also its culture. Artists' unions were introduced, which led to lots of mediocrity. Before 1914, Vienna, as I said, had been multicultural, with high attractivity for young people from all over the monarchy. Most significant for Vienna was that many young, highly gifted Jews from eastern parts of the empire saw Vienna correctly as the possibility for their personal future. A very significant part of the intellectual and art life of Vienna was supported by Jews from various parts of the empire. Erich Kandel, in his book The Age of Insight, remarks that the contribution of Jews to the intellectual and artistic life in Vienna is comparable probably only to their contribution to in Moorish Spain. This is a very interesting remark. After 1918, this attractiveness of Vienna immediately ended, and Vienna fell back into provincialism. In architecture, Bauhaus and Deutscher Werkbund had no real foothold in Vienna. Richard Neutra, who had been influenced by Adolf Loos, emigrated around 1930 to the US, where he became a representative of classical modernity. Of the large cultural level in Vienna after the war, literature was probably the most significant one. The most important names here are Robert Musil, Franz Kafka, Ödön von Horváth, Heim Mieter von Toda and Stefan Zweig. The year of 1920 saw the beginning of the Salzburg Festival with the first performance of Jedermann. Contemporary music had begun in 1913, which had probably its most significant event with the Watschenkonzert, also known as the Skandalkonzert, with Schönberg in the Musikverein, which ended with fist fights in the audience. After the war, Schönberg created a Verein für musikalische Privataufführungen, where they performed for the first time pieces by Gustav Mahler, Richard Strauss, Béla Bartók, and Igor Stravinsky. Talking about science, the, in my opinion, most significant figure in the late 1800s was Ludwig Boltzmann, who put thermodynamics on the solid footing of molecular kinetics. Boltzmann was very interested in the philosophical foundations of physics, as witnessed, for example, by his book Prinzipien der Naturphilosophie, where he writes philosophy with two Fs, not with PHs. The unusual spelling is due to the fact that Boltzmann not only wanted to change physics, he also wanted to reform and economize the writing of the German language. Boltzmann's experimental colleague was Josef Stefan, who, and that again is significant for the time back then, was of Slovenian origin. A most influential figure was certainly Ernst Mach. To him, the world consisted primarily of our sensations. Apparently, his lectures were broadly attended, including by Hofmannsthal. Mach, therefore, influenced many areas of intellectual endeavor. For example, Hans Kelsen, who I already mentioned, was motivated to his positivist theory of law. Kelsen is credited for having written after the war the Constitution for the Young Austrian Republic. Kelsen there introduced for the first time an independent constitutional court, Verfassungsgerichtshof. Kelsen, by thoroughly analyzing the fundamentals of a legal, systematic and consistent constitutional system, found out that it is necessary to have an independent constitutional court. Such a court has to be separate from any other Supreme Court in order to serve as an independent watchguard over the other bodies of government and the judiciary, to make sure that the constitutional rules are obeyed. The introduction of a constitutional court was later followed by many other countries. Likewise, Albert Einstein, I mentioned him even as he was not part of the Viennese culture, certainly, but he was actually for a brief time professor in Prague at the Karls University, as you might know. And I like to say that the signature of Franz Josef appointing Einstein to the professorship in Prague was probably one of the most significant or most positive signatures Franz Josef ever did. But that's a small side remark. Likewise, Albert Einstein acknowledged that Mach's analysis, specifically that of space and time, had been of profound influence for him to develop his special theory of relativity. It has also been argued that Mach influenced the notion of observables introduced by people like Niels Bohr and Werner Heisenberg. The Vienna Circle of the 1920s continued that kind of fundamental analysis and aimed to put science on a firm logical and philosophical basis. It was also called Schlick-Kreis after the philosopher Moritz Schlick, who came from interestingly Protestant Bohemian nobility. This again signifies the breadth of the intellectual basis of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Wittgenstein in 1928, after a number of attempts, finally met the Schlick-Kreis, where he then, instead of doing philosophy, read poetry. He was until then engaged in building the Wittgenstein House in Vienna immediately before 1928. And if you ever come to Vienna, I would like to show it to you. It's not so publicly accessible. It is clear that the Austro-Hungarian Empire provided, as I mentioned a couple of times, a large pool for talent. After 1918, that connection evidently broke off. There were a number of Nobel Prizes given to Austrians between the wars, but most of them were based on achievements from better times. There was significant emigration of scientists from Austria around 1919 or later, as for example Karl Landsteiner, Nobel Prize in Medicine 1930, Richard Kuhn, Physics Nobel Prize in 1938, Wolfgang Pauli, Physics Nobel Prize in 1945, and George de Heveschi, Physics Nobel Prize in 1943. I think that was the chemistry prize, actually. That was, Physiker. The physicist Friedrich Hasenröhrl, before the war, was considered by many as one of the hopes for Austrian physics for the future. He had found the equivalence between mass and energy before Einstein. Regretfully, he died in action in 1915 in South Tirol, today called Alto Adige. When this happened, apparently, a very insightful administrator in the Austrian ministry, responsible for the universities, identified Erwin Schrödinger as the next promising Austrian talent in physics. He made sure that Schrödinger was positioned to do his army duty in a location where there was little danger to his life. He, namely Schrödinger, himself describes how boring it was to watch from the hills above Trieste the movements of ships on the Adriatic Sea, which was his duty. Remarkably, but certainly no more than a coincidence, this was not far away from Duino, where in 1908 Boltzmann had committed suicide and where Rainer Maria Rilke had begun to write his Duineser Elegien before the war. Rilke was one of the authors whose abilities to write were completely stopped by the war. Only in 1922 he was able to finish his masterpiece. In his autobiography, Schrödinger remarked that he had hoped to become a professor in Czernowitz, which was an eastern part of the empire, but he writes, as I quote, "Czernowitz soon was not ours anymore," end of the quote, and his hope for spending the rest of his life teaching a little physics and doing most of the time philosophy was not fulfilled, as he writes. Similarly, Oskar Kokoschka in the war trenches promised to dedicate himself only to the beauty of the world in the future. This can clearly be seen in the changing character of his paintings. Stefan Zweig, in his Welt von gestern, World of Yesterday, describes the loss. I quote, "The war destroyed the isolation from reality which the bourgeois home provided," end of the quote. The people emerging from that isolation were unprepared. In provincial post-war Austria, there were in all political camps radicals and moderates. Over the time, unfortunately, again in all camps, the radicals won over the moderates with devastating political consequences leading to Austrofascism and Austro-Marxism. In my opinion, this also contributed to the inability of Austria to position itself strongly against the rise of National Socialism. In 1894, the Vienna Secession was created by Gustav Klimt, Koloman Moser, Josef Hoffmann and others. These artists broke away from the Künstlerhaus to protest against the then popular historicism and conservatism. They explicitly protested against the, in their eyes, too important commercial aspects for artists. They made the quality of art the primary criterion. It may not have been insignificant that in 1918, the passing away of such important figures as Gustav Klimt, Egon Schiele, Kolo Moser, and Otto Wagner happened in just that year. Again, going a little into the future, Claudio Magris talked about the Habsburg mythos, as he calls it, not as a nostalgia, but as a way to analyze the past. A crown witness is Josef Roth, who came from Eastern Galicia and who wrote his Radetzky March in 1933, an everlasting memory to the lost world. But post-war Austria was not as narrow-minded in all aspects as it is often perceived. It might be remarked that, for example, the opera Wozzeck by Alban Berg had been premiered in Berlin in 1977, where it led to huge protests, particularly from Nazis and right-wing radical students. In contrast, in Vienna in 1930, it was rather well received. Maybe this bears witness to a, at that time, still more open atmosphere. Another remarkable figure is Ödön von Horváth, who, for example, in his Geschichten aus dem Wienerwald, Tales from the Vienna Woods of 1931, clearly rejected the mythos of the operetta. He uncovered the practices of everyday fascism in a patriarchal world in the old days. Most significant memories of the time were given by Stefan Zweig in his World of Yesterday, and by Robert Musil in his Der Mann ohne Eigenschaften, The Man Without Qualities, where he says about Kakania. Kakania is the name of the empire, it comes from KK, Kaiserlich, Königlich, and so on. No disguise to try to have as many titles as possible. Emperor is not enough. I quote, "Of course cars rolled on these roads too, but not too many. The conquest of the air was being prepared here too, but not too intensely. A ship would now and then be sent off to South America or East Asia, but not too often. There was no ambition for world markets or world power. Here at the very center of Europe, where the world's old axis crossed, words such as colony and overseas sounded like something quite untried and remote. There was some show of luxury, but by no means in such over-refined ways," as he writes, "as the French. People went in for sports, but not as fanatically as the English. Ruinous sums of money were spent on the army, but only just enough to secure its position as the second weakest among the great powers. The capital, too, was somewhat smaller than all the other big cities of the world, but considerably greater than a mere big city. Most interestingly, in Austria itself, there was no systematic intellectual or otherwise investigation or analysis of the time around 1900. The investigations between the wars, the investigations were essentially opened up by non-Austrians. Most significantly already mentioned in Wittgenstein's Vienna by Alan Janik and Stephen Tulmin in 1973 and in Fin de siècle Vienna Politics and Culture by Karl Eschorski from 1980. But in between lay the painful times of National Socialism, the expulsion of thinking and of intellectuals, and the destruction of the European Jews. In Vienna, the most significant event opening up the mind to the time was the exhibition Traum und Wirklichkeit, Dream and Reality, Vienna 1870 to 1930. It was organized by the Historical Museum of the City of Vienna in the Künstlerhaus and took place from March to October 1985. The mayor of Vienna at that time, Helmut Zilk, writes in the introduction, "The memory of Vienna around 1900 is a challenge for our future. I hardly know a more fascinating one." I would like to come back to my personal remarks at the beginning of my small presentation. The special climate of Vienna, in my opinion, was made possible by the fact that Vienna was the center of a multicultural, multi-ethnic empire, a rather unique situation which did not happen in that way in other European countries, together with its smallness. This opened up new ways of looking beneath the surfaces. These were theatrical surfaces whose existence was probably a necessary precondition for the uncompromising search for deep truth. This tension between outside and inside can still be felt in Vienna today. J'arrive à la fin de mes considérations. Comme je l'ai déjà dit au début, il s'agit de mon point de vue personnel. Je ne suis pas sûr si certains arguments sont assez précis ou des erreurs historiques sont introduites. Dans ce cas, je vous prie d'attirer mon attention. Naturellement, nous devons nous demander si l'on peut en tirer des conséquences pour l'avenir. Je tiens beaucoup à discuter et à analyser cet aspect avec vous. Je vous remercie sincèrement pour votre patience et votre attention.